Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments since 1937. Supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It would be possible, I suppose, to overstate how worried the Federal Reserve is about inflation, but not really by very much. Just the other day, we read the minutes of their last meeting and how they're worried their own forecasts of rising prices might be too tame. But what if it's not that way at all? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, April 13th. Good to have you here. There was a raft of numbers out today you could plow through if you were so inclined. A report showed Americans are less sanguine about the economy than they've been in 8 months. Prices at the pump and problems in the housing market combined to drive consumer sentiment down. All the same, that was indeed a sigh of relief you heard from Wall Street today, because inflation's turning out to be no big deal. Marketplace's Steve Henn explains wholesale prices held mostly steady last month.
Wholesale prices for March rose more than expected, up a full 1%. But most of the increase came in the form of rising fuel prices. Core inflation, which excludes energy and food costs, was flat. Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial.
Coming into this report, we've had 2 months in a row where every release showed an increasing rate of inflation at the core.
Lowe was worried if the rate of core inflation didn't ease, the Federal Reserve would be forced to raise interest rates. Today's inflation report provided a bit of breathing room, but Peter Morici at the University of Maryland doesn't think we're out of the woods yet.
1 percentage point for just a month is a lot, and I expect another big number in April.
Morici says what's driving inflation, high gas prices and extremely expensive veggies, may not bother officials at the Fed, but it's going to drive consumers crazy. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Steve mentioned veggies. You might have seen this at the supermarket yourselves. Fresh vegetable prices shot up 13.5% last month. Earlier this week, the biggest student loan company in the country, Sallie Mae, said it would pay the state of New York a $2 million fine to settle allegations of improper conduct. Some in Congress are calling for a federal investigation into the student loan mess, not to mention changes to regulations, none of which has left Sallie Mae the worse for wear. The New York Times reports today private equity groups might be interested in buying up the lender despite all the troubles. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out what the appeal might be.
The New York Times is reporting that a private equity firm, possibly Blackstone, is interested in buying Sallie Mae. The company is said to be offering more than $20 billion. So what would they get for that kind of money?
First of all, you get the largest student lender in the country.
Samir Gokhale is an analyst with Keefe, Bruyette & Woods. Sallie Mae has a market value of $16.7 billion. It has federally subsidized loans and private ones, a debt collection business, and a loan servicing department.
What that means is they have the greatest economies of scale because they have the largest loan portfolio.
He says Sallie Mae is one of the few private lenders that's allowed to back its own loans. Most lenders pay hefty fees to a third party to do that. And with the cost of college rising as fast as it is, the student loan business is decidedly a growth industry. But it's a risky industry right now, too. There are several investigations going on in Congress looking into lending practices. The House passed a bill earlier this year that would cut the interest rates on federally subsidized student loans. And that was all before this month's news of improper ties between lenders and financial aid offices. Prudential's Charles Gabriel says the real question is
whether the legislative debate itself begins to reduce the interest of the financial players and the private equity players, because that legislative debate looks like it might portend a changed business model.
But analyst Gokhale says that doesn't matter. He thinks Sallie Mae's assets are so valuable and so underpriced that the company could even end up starting a bidding war. In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is the deadline for North Korea to shut down its nuclear reactor if it wants to get its hands on some sorely needed foreign oil. Pyongyang claims it's ready to let inspectors in to verify the shutdown. The hitch in the deal is $25 million sitting in a bank in Macau, we think. From Washington, Remy Innocencio explains what's been happening to the money the U.S. had denied the North Koreans access to.
The real question is, where is the money and why isn't it moving? John Park, Korean affairs expert at the U.S. Institute of Peace, says he's got a plausible explanation. The North Koreans still haven't withdrawn their $25 million from Banco Delta Asia because they can't. Macau has said only authorized account holders can pick up the money. And if you look at the breakdown of those funds,
$13 million of the $25 million has been claimed to be clean, and the $12 million remaining is reputed to be derived from illicit activities.
Which means half of it may belong to other people or is just plain illegal. To move that money from Macau to North Korea, the main proposed pathway is through China. But China says the funds issue has actually not yet been resolved, despite U.S. claims to the contrary.
The Bank of China has stated on the record that they are uncomfortable handling money that has been officially designated as having been derived from illicit activity.
There's another reason China is leery of handling tainted money.
Their credit rating would take a significant hit, which would make their access to international capital markets that much more expensive.
And Bruce Bennett, North Korea analyst with the RAND Corporation, says even if the check cleared right now, Yongbyon couldn't be turned off suddenly.
No, the experts are saying that because shutdown has not begun already, it would be almost impossible to achieve that by the 14th.
But if North Korea does get its money, the country would then get a total of 1 million tons of heavy fuel oil. In Washington, I'm Remy Innocencio for Marketplace.
Wall Street managed to turn things around this morning after a slowish start. We'll have the details and a talk with the stockbroker from Dallas when we do the numbers. The Labor Department publishes something called the Occupational Outlook Handbook. It's revised every 2 years. It tracks hundreds of jobs in the U.S. economy. In the most recent edition, home health aide is listed as one of this country's fastest-growing professions. There are about 1.2 million people in that line of work right now. Demand for their services is expected to rise 35% by 2014, despite long hours and low wages. On Monday, home health workers and how they're paid will be one topic of oral argument at the Supreme Court, as Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Looking at her now, it's hard to imagine Evelyn Koch taking care of someone else. The former home health aide is 73, a frail, shrunken figure dwarfed by the couch she's sitting on. She admits her memory isn't what it was, but she looks back with nostalgia on the job she did for 20 years after she immigrated to the U.S. from Jamaica.
I cook. I bed sick people. I go shopping for them. I wash their clothes. And I always take the best care.
But Koch says the agency she worked for didn't take care of her. She says her bosses rarely paid her overtime when she worked overnights and weekends. Under New York state law, home health aides are entitled to overtime based on the state minimum wage. But most states don't have any such law, so most aides don't get any overtime. Koch's Supreme Court case seeks to ensure that every aide in the country is entitled to federal minimum wage and overtime pay, that is, time and a half on their actual hourly wage. Craig Becker is Evelyn Koch's lawyer. He says the job of caring for someone at home used to revolve around an informal network of children and neighbors, but now it's an industry.
Giving them the basic protections which all other workers have, ensuring that they make a decent wage, is going to lead to more workers taking up this occupation and staying in it.
But the agencies that employ the aides and the government say paying aides more will mean many seniors won't be able to afford care. What's more, the agencies say if they had to shell out all that overtime, they'd go out of business. You see, agencies get around two-thirds of their costs covered by Medicare and Medicaid. David Grabowski teaches healthcare economics at Harvard Medical School. He says if the court decides aides are entitled to overtime,
home healthcare agencies aren't going to be able to directly pass these costs back to Medicare. Medicare is going to have to make a decision to actually increase the rates that they pay these home health care agencies.
The question is, will they do that? Laurie Reynolds hopes so. Reynolds is 44 and has been an aide for 8 years. At the moment, she works on Long Island for a woman who's debilitated after having had a stroke. Reynolds doesn't want to switch professions because she really loves the job.
I've always found it as a blessing to be around older people and anybody that can't help themselves. I don't care where they from or who they are. If I can do something for you, that's just joy for me also.
But she doesn't love the money. She earns $8.50 an hour, which is better than the pay of some aides she knows. She says when aides feel underappreciated, patients can suffer.
I ride the bus and I hear the women saying, for what I'm making, I'm not going in there doing this and I'm not going in there doing that. And I feel if they were making better income, their wages was better, their attitude would be a little more different.
Harvard Medical School's David Grabowski agrees the status quo is far from ideal. But he says if the Supreme Court rules in favor of overtime for aides,
the burden then really shifts to the agencies and the payers of these services. Agencies are basically left with two options. They can either deliver fewer services or they can raise prices.
Neither of which is good news for patients. Of course, he says, if Medicare and Medicaid decided to increase their reimbursements to agencies, there would be fewer problems. But he says, given that both programs have tried to limit home health spending recently, he's not that optimistic. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Our stockbroker guy down in Dallas has given up his peripatetic ways. David Johnson is back home again. How are you?
Wait a minute. Is that the stuff you take for an acid stomach, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
How about Friday the 13th?
I got through the whole show without mentioning it, and then bang, here you are. You wrecked it.
Well, I'm breaking the jinx. Well, Dow was up.
Yeah.
Breath was up. You've had a great show so far. I mean, it's not
absolutely
over yet.
But here's the deal. It was really a story of one stock today, right?
Well, it certainly was, and it sort of shows you what a rotten index the Dow Jones Industrials average is, but you can't get away from it. Merck was the one stock, up $3.85. It's one of the Dow 30, so you multiply whatever gain you have in a single Dow stock by 8 to transfer. So if it had been up $4, that would be 32, the bulk of the industrials average gain. But you know, we broke the trend. Wednesday looked spooky. Mm-hmm. Wednesday looked like that was going to be the breaking point.
Yeah, and yet here we are at the end of a very weird week saying not such bad things.
Yeah, you know, you're kind of walking on your tiptoes, and there's plenty of bad stuff out there, but Wall Street doesn't pay attention to it. For, you know, since we finished on an up note, I'll talk about the bad stuff this week. But this deal, well, always a contrarian.
Yeah, that's right.
The National Association of Realtors came out earlier this week, and they said that for the first time since they started gathering data, that the value of a home in America is going to drop. Not much, but it's going to drop.
Yeah, homeowners of the world unite. That's sort of a troubling little statistic there for a whole lot of reasons.
I think it's a very, very troubling statistic. Then we had a report out that the sales tax revenues for the nation's states is coming in below expectations. So you have two indicators that both sort of point to a slowdown in the economy. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is why these inflation numbers that we had here today, and more importantly, the inflation numbers we have next week, consumer price index, right, are so important. Because you know the dirty word, and we can say it because we're friends.
Go ahead.
Right?
Oh, yeah. No, it's a family
stagflation.
Show. Yeah.
Stagnant economy with inflation. This is designed to keep you awake at night.
Let me ask you about something we've been talking about for a couple of weeks here. This prospect that corporate earnings are slowing down a little bit, does that play into this at all?
Yeah, I think it does, except that, you know, when everybody knows something on Wall Street, it's not a surprise. And so the expectation was for, you know, this 3.3% increase in corporate earnings. Now, the fact is, you take a look at McDonald's today and Merck and the retailers the other day, it makes you think maybe they're wrong and the earnings are going to be better than expected. But don't worry, we'll find something else to worry about.
See, that's why we have you on the radio.
But, you know, you got to just – so I tell you, I've been doing this for a long time, and I just never cease to be amazed. When you have a rotten week, potentially really rotten week like that, yeah. This, and you've got to pay taxes next week and all the horrible things going on, you know, the stock market gods take care of you.
David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Guy. Right.
All righty, you too. Coming up, the greening of America.
Green is the most strategic, capitalistic, and I think progressive ideology now for rebuilding America's future.
But first, let's do the numbers. Seems there were few worries on Wall Street this Friday the 13th. The Dow Industrials enjoyed 59 points worth of good fortune. That's a gain of almost 0.5% to finish the week at 12,612. The NASDAQ advanced by the same margin percentage-wise, added 11 points to close at 2,491. The S&P 500 tacked on 0.3%, 5 points, ending at 1,452. So the Dow has finished higher in 10 out of the last 11 trading sessions and gained 0.4% since Monday. The NASDAQ had an even better week, climbing 0.8%. The S&P 500 picked up 0.2% over the past 5 days. Shares of SLM Corporation jumped by their biggest margin in almost 23 years. The stock surged almost 15%. How come? SLM is better known as Sally Mae. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for March. On Tax Day Eve, the Americans for Tax Reform sponsors a news conference at the National Press Club. And the 2,335th star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame goes to Oscar-winning actor Forrest Whitaker in front of the Kodak Theater. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We heard Johnson talking about corporate profits and how single-digit percentage gains are nothing to be ashamed of. Well, get a load of this one. The Indian firm Infosys reported earnings this morning, up 70% from a year ago, most of it from American companies outsourcing back office and technology jobs. So many of them that call centers in places like Mumbai and Bangalore have helped boost India's growing middle class and contributed to the Indian cultural dynamic. Miranda Kennedy reports now from Mumbai on how Bollywood's cashing in.
The show, India Calling, is one of the hundreds of primetime soap operas fueling India's Hindi language entertainment channels. Only this one is set in a call center. India Calling is about Chandni, a small-town girl who scores her ultimate goal. She gets a job in a sleek call center office in the big city. She works nights making telemarketing calls to the U.S., but the job is anything but perfect.
Crack the deal. Come on.
This is the scene where Chandni takes her first call. It's a painfully slow, melodramatic scene in which an Indian impersonates a nasty American on the other end of the line.
Hey, hi. This is JSK of Kent and Cathay Associates from LA. So what the hell did I just tell you? Did you just hear my requirement?
Son, I don't...
The way the Indian call center worker has been the source of ridicule in the U.S., the angry American caller has become legend in India. Call centers employ around 600,000 people here. Because the industry has propelled India into the global marketplace, the phenomenon has an outsized impact on middle-class culture. It spawned a couple TV shows and a best-selling novel called One Night at the Call Center, in which demanding customers make the workers' lives miserable. It'll be released as a Bollywood film later this year.
There is a social impact on India right now because of the easy money that's coming to the youngsters in the call center. They're all getting jobs. They don't have to be qualified. All they have to do is learn how to speak English.
Srishti Arya, producer of India Calling, says she decided to set the show on a call center because everyone knows about them, even in rural India. But although the job pays well, it's not really seen as a reputable profession in socially conservative India, partly because of the nighttime hours.
Of course, we had angry, abusive callers. We had people lying about working in a call center. We had women being looked at suspiciously by their neighbors because they'd leave in the night and come back in the morning. One of the girls was saying that in my society, they used to say, oh, there goes the call girl, the call center girl.
In real life, call center workers are often accused of rejecting Indian family values for a frivolous, consumerist lifestyle. There's no doubt they're reshaping the country's spending and social habits. That's more than enough material to feed some 200 episodes of India Calling. A major theme of the show is how stressful it is for call center workers to assume a different identity, like Sam from Cincinnati. Mansi Parekh plays Chandni, the lead character. She says her character embodies the frustrations of working in a call center.
Indians speak English in a different way. Americans speak English in a different way. Why do we have to speak the way they have to? They don't change their accent when they're talking to us. Then why should we change our accent while we're talking to them?
Chandni breaks the mold and refuses to go by her adopted American name, Kathy.
So, Kathy?
No, sir. You were speaking to Chandni.
Chandni?
Chandni, sir. My parents have named me Chandni. And this is the way we Indians speak. I'm not ashamed of who I am. And will never be.
It works. The American on the other end of the line buys the hair care products from Chandni, not Kathy.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
After that, everyone else in the call center drops their fake names and accents, too. Chandni prevails over the bad-tempered Americans, and the show crescendos to a patriotic finish. It may not be likely, but it's a Bollywood ending. In Mumbai, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Marketplace.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has become an unlikely poster child for the environmental movement. He's on the cover of the current issue of Newsweek magazine under a headline that says, "Save the planet or else." Earlier this week, in a speech at Georgetown University, he said it's time to change environmentalism's image, turn it around, make it sexy, in the same way that Schwarzenegger says he helped bodybuilding become sexy back in the 1970s. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman thinks green needs a makeover, too, although perhaps not by pumping iron. He'll have an article in the magazine this Sunday. And, Mr. Friedman, I got to tell you, your piece reads more like a manifesto than anything else.
It is meant as a manifesto, and it's really meant to lay out a new political philosophy that basically argues that green is the most strategic, capitalistic, and I think progressive ideology now for rebuilding America's future. By confronting climate change, by taking the lead in doing that, by setting really high standards for our industries and businesses, we are going to stimulate, we can stimulate, enormous amount of innovation that will really strengthen our companies to compete globally in what is clearly going to be the next great global industry, Kai, and that is clean technology.
But the common wisdom here has been that green requires some kind of sacrifice. We have to cut back if we're going to be able to do anything about global warming.
Well, it's going to require sacrifice if we don't do anything about global warming because the Mother Nature will impose restraints on us. But if we can really be smart about this, set standards early, really stimulate the innovation, I think there's still a very good chance we can maintain our basic way of life without having to cut back, without having to pay that big a price.
Give me some examples. How are you going to sell it to Americans that they can have, in essence, the same with less?
Well, let's look at California, for instance. California imposed very high efficiency standards on buildings and appliances, you know, 3 decades ago. And as a result of that, on a per capita basis, energy use in California has been flat for the last 30 years, while it's grown 50% in the rest of the country. Because the government imposed these standards, introduced them, stimulated the innovation, that was the result. We got stronger companies, more efficient buildings, lower energy usage, and I would say more comfortable consumers.
All right. Well, let me extend it a little bit and turn it back on you. Would you agree that nothing's going to happen in fixing global warming or climate change or going green strategically unless China goes with us, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we go to China and we say, listen, we have a way that you can get clean energy to turn on that light bulb or to do whatever it is, but it's going to cost you a little bit extra. But you know what? It's really important that we take care of global warming. They're going to look at us and say, why should we pay extra? We're fine burning dirty coal and burning oil and developing our economy at 10% a year. And so long as the light's on, what do we care where it comes from?
That is what they'll say. But here's why it's an advantage for us. I'm going to give you the example I give in the piece of GE Transportation. GE Transportation is based in Erie, Pennsylvania, the American Rust Belt. What do they sell? They sell choo-choo trains, big old industry things. Guess what? Erie, Pennsylvania today has a trade surplus with China and Mexico because GE Transportation sells locomotives to China, which is, by the way, a railroad country which makes its own locomotives. Why do the Chinese buy GE locomotives? Because they are so energy efficient because of some of the standards we've already imposed on our manufacturers that even though the GE locomotive costs much more than the Chinese locomotive, the total cost of operating it for the railroad is less because it's so energy efficient.
So there's a lowest common denominator price that we have to meet in the Chinese market before anything's going to happen.
Yeah, unless we get down to the China price, the price at which clean technology, whether it's clean coal, solar, or wind, can scale in China, we really haven't solved this problem at all.
Let's play a little word game here. You ready?
Ready.
Take the word green, mm-hmm. Substitute the last letter with a D. What do you get?
You get greed.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, I like greed. I like greed, Kai, because unless you get the marketplace working for you, you'll never really develop the scale of green technologies and the innovation you need. It's so important that prices be set at a level that they will stimulate the innovation that we need to really get green as a country and as a world. And the only thing that can do that is government setting high standards and then telling the marketplace, may the best man or woman win. Go at it.
Thomas Friedman is a columnist for the New York Times. He's got a piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine this weekend. It's called The Power of Green. Mr. Friedman, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. And by the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, Google decided to ruin a perfectly good Friday for business reporters. This afternoon, the company announced it's buying online ad rival DoubleClick, thus consolidating its internet ad dominance. The price tag is $3.1 billion, cash, because Google has it to spare, of course. DoubleClick was a dot-com star the first time round. It survived the bloodletting after the first boom turned bust. All in all, the deal's almost double the size of Google's biggest acquisition so far. That would be YouTube. And that is Marketplace on a Friday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 59 points, almost 0.5%. The NASDAQ picked up 11 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 rose 5 points. That is a third of 1% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up Monday on the program, Sudan looks to the east.
Heretofore, the economic center of the world was somewhere between the United States and Europe, and that center of gravity is shifting. So what's happening in Africa is a manifestation of that competition.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.